phone and gestured for me to read. I had texted him at 11 p.m., claiming to be too ill to ride in the morning. I had texted him again at midnight, saying I had to go to the office to catch up on grading and wouldn't be able to make it to our ride. Between 1 and 3 a.m., I had sent a series of unintelligible letters. It wasn't the first time I had lied to get out of a Sunday morning ride, but it was the first time I had failed to successfully disguise the reason why. Carlos, who had read all the messages upon waking, assumed I was seriously ill. He used his emergency key to let himself into my apartment, where he discovered my body reverberating with snores on the bed. When he tried to shake me awake, I didn't stir. He was about to call an ambulance when he noticed an overturned glass on my nightstand and an empty box of wine next to the bed. "What the hell is going on?" he demanded. I didn't have an answer. I knew there was no way I could come out of this looking good, but I certainly didn't need to look as bad as I actually was. The truth was too disappointing. I muttered something about having friends over the night before, even though I had actually spent the night alone. Carlos glared at me wearily. He knew I was lying. My secret was out. I was a fuck-up. "Fine," he said, standing up from the couch. "Let's go."
"Go where?"
I asked nervously.
"It's Sunday morning," Carlos sighed irritably. "Wasn't it obvious? Don't fucking think you're getting out of this ride."
That bike ride was the worst 2 hours of my life. My hangover symptoms were intense, but paled in comparison to the pain I felt every time Carlos looked at me. I knew that he was finally seeing what I truly was, a drunk and a liar. The disappointment seared into my skin like a branding iron. I never missed another Sunday morning ride. I didn't want to disappoint anyone the way I had disappointed Carlos that day. I wish I could also say I never drank again after that, but in reality, the experience only made me a more careful liar. My drinking continued in secret for 2 more years, escalating until the day I woke up on the floor of my home covered in blood. At some point in the night, sometime after that second glass of wine, I had fallen and hit my head on a bookshelf. Terrified, I knew what I had to do. "I need help." I shook with fear as I finally admitted the truth out loud for the first time. I divulged everything to Carlos. The drinking, the lies, the not-enoughs, the shame and guilt. He didn't say anything. He just wrapped his arms around me and held on tight as I fell apart. I had feared telling the truth for so long, yet in that moment I felt relieved. My flaws were met with compassion, not rejection. With that admission, I felt like I could finally begin to create a life that matched the person living it. I didn't have to lie anymore. The truth is this. I'm an alcoholic. And that truth fits me like a custom-made frock. It's not the garb I would have picked out for myself, but it's comfortable, and I can twirl about in it. Sobriety hasn't been a magic cure-all. I'm still me, just without the box of wine. The insecurities are still there. Some days the not-enoughs rattle around in my brain. It takes a lot of work and a lot of honesty, even when honesty makes me look bad. But I finally understand that my flaws don't make me a failure. For the longest time, I thought Carlos had made me ride my bike that day as punishment for being such a fuck-up. But now I realize that wasn't the case at all. Just as Carlos had a backward way of paying someone a compliment, he also had a backward way of showing love. He was mad. The maddest I've ever seen him, yet he never gave up on me or on our friendship. The realization was profound. I can be a fuck-up and still be worthy of love. When the not-enoughs creep in these days, I think of that moment of unconditional love from Carlos, and I don't feel so bad. I actually feel all right. Chapter 14. Life as I Know It. Slowly but surely, I began to rebuild my life.
I found that without drinking, I experienced a glut of both time and energy, which I used to throw myself full bore into a burgeoning writing hobby. I had never considered myself a writer before, but a friend asked if he could post a race report I'd emailed him on his blog. That led to other blogs, which led to discovery by an editor at a national running magazine. He offered me my own column, to which I replied with a very professional question of, "Are you high?" He was not high. I still write the column. Triathlon was put on the back burner, my bike seeing action only on Sunday mornings when I rode with Carlos. For the remaining days of the week, I was committed to running, with a firm goal of qualifying for the Boston Marathon. I'd like to say this was part of a deeper plan for personal growth, and that is partly true. However, most of the impetus was purely financial. At an editorial meeting one day, my handlers knocked around an idea for their next bestseller. Take an everyday schmo and create a Boston qualifying specimen. Guess who was the biggest schmo on staff? It would be my big break, as both a writer and an athlete. Carlos was elated when I showed him my book deal. He said, chuckling to himself, "And to think, you didn't even want to run in the first place." He, too, was experiencing a rebirth of sorts. One year after being told he had 6 months to live, Carlos was still very much alive. He was tired, gaunt, and weakened, but joyfully alive. Better yet, he'd been informed that he was cancer-free. The doctors gave him the go-ahead to rebuild the body that had been ravaged by a year-long onslaught of surgeries, chemotherapy, and radiation. When we received the news that the cancer was in remission, there was much jubilation. There was gratitude. There were a few tears. Most importantly, there was normalcy. Carlos took to track workouts with gusto and convinced me to fold some swim workouts with him into my Boston training plan. Racing was on his radar, too. "If I'm still in remission at my next checkup, I'll register for a 5K. With a mischievous grin, he leaned in and whispered, "And who knows, maybe I'll do another Ironman someday." I had my best friend and training partner back. Life as I knew it had returned. The bliss was short-lived. 4 months after being declared cancer-free, Carlos texted me from his doctor's office. "Two tumors in liver. Surgery not an option." It felt like someone had reached through my phone and punched me hard in the gut. Things had finally returned to normal, only to be upended all over again. A few days later, over lunch, he described the size and location of the tumors and what it meant for the future. "It looks like my options are pretty limited, but we'll give them all a shot. Don't close the book on me just yet. I've got a feeling there's still a few more chapters left." I smiled. "Yes, there are." I asked my doctor if he thought I could still do a triathlon. He said he didn't see why not. "Of course," I said, mirroring his optimism and thinking of an upcoming local sprint that would be perfect to train for together. "Might as well." "So I'm going to sign up for Ironman Arizona." I choked on the sip of water I had just taken. "What?" I sputtered. Carlos flashed that grin I had come to associate with his mischief during the 7 years of our friendship. "You in?" The timing couldn't have been worse. I was knee-deep in training for a Boston qualifier, which was ridiculously far out of my comfort zone. I had already announced this goal to the readers of my column. The ink on my book contract was barely dry. I had deadlines to meet for the magazine each week. I was still teaching full-time. There was no way I could train for a long-distance triathlon. No way. An Ironman simply did not fit into my plans. I looked at Carlos's eager expression. "Yeah," I said. "I'm in." Boston could wait. I needed to train for Ironman Arizona first. There was a lot I didn't know. I didn't know how Carlos would handle training for an Ironman on top of the rigors of cancer treatment. I didn't know how the doctors would treat Carlos this time around, or if it would even work. I didn't know how much time he, or I, or anyone else had left on this planet. But what I did know was that if some of his precious time was going to be spent training for an Iron Man, there was no place I wanted to be more than on his back wheel every Sunday. Life as I knew it had returned. Chapter 15. Sunday Mornings. With Iron Man Arizona on the horizon, our Sunday morning bike rides became more important than ever. Though we agreed that the rides themselves were critical, Carlos and I would often bicker over the details. Every Saturday, we kicked off our weekly haggle over our Sunday morning ride with a series of text messages. Me. Riding 3 hours tomorrow, South Mountain, leave at 9 a.m. Him. Leave at 7 a.m. Me. It's cold at 7. 9. Him. Not that cold. 7. Me. Compromise. Meet at 8. Him. Quit whining. 7. Me. You're an asshole. Him. Love you too. See you at 7. On Sunday morning, I'd drag myself out of bed early and chug several cups of coffee before riding to meet Carlos in a parking lot midway between our houses. "Can you take it easy on me today?" I would always ask. "Of course," Carlos would always reply, smiling. Let the record show that Carlos Nunez is a big fat liar. One would think multiple rounds of chemotherapy and several intensive surgeries would slow a man down. At least, that was my logic when I decided to train with him for this Iron Man. He's been through a lot, but hey, silver lining, he's probably slow enough that I can finally keep up with him on the bike. Yes, these thoughts confirm that I am a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad friend. As it turns out, not only was I awful, but my logic was not sound. Those Sunday rides were humbling, sometimes so humbling that I would threaten to throw my bike off the side of the mountain. "You're supposed to be sick, dude," I would wheeze while trying to keep up with him. "Act like it." "And you're supposed to be in shape," he would retort. "Act like it." After a particularly rough Sunday on the bike, I came home to several text messages from elated friends, all of whom had qualified for Boston at a local marathon that day. Though I felt bad for even thinking it, I resented giving up my own marathon training in order to struggle behind Carlos every Sunday. I couldn't help but wonder if I had made the right decision by signing up to do another Ironman triathlon. Though I was ashamed of my selfishness, that night I surreptitiously browsed marathon websites, the way a husband looks at pornography websites after his wife goes to bed. The following weekend brought yet another round of text messages between Carlos and me, and another early morning Sunday meet-up in the cold. We rode our familiar route in our familiar way, with me huffing and puffing as he pulled farther away from me on the mountain. As always, the ride became a game of hide-and-go-seek. I'd turn a corner, and there he'd be, dancing on the pedals, seemingly without effort, a few hundred yards in front of me. When I finally reached the top, Carlos was waiting for me. He pointed at his watch and shrugged quizzically, as if to say, "What took you so long?" I pointed too, with my middle finger. He laughed as he rolled out toward the descent. If you've never ridden your bike down a mountain, you're missing out. The contrast of the pain going up and the effortless speed going down creates pure childlike joy. You can't help but have a big, stupid grin on your face. There is no better feeling in the world than flying down a mountain on a bike. That is, until you get to the bottom and see an identical grin on your best friend's face. A grin you once feared you'd never see again. Suddenly, I remembered exactly why I was training for this Iron Man. This decision had nothing to do with the actual race. It had nothing to do with bikes, nothing to do with humility, and nothing to do with Boston. It had everything to do with Sunday mornings and big, stupid grins. As we headed toward home, the sun warmed our wind-burned cheeks and numb fingers. I looked to my left, where Carlos was riding, still grinning. "Hey, sir?"
"Yeah?"
"I'm glad we're doing this."
"Me too."
"Next week?" Yes. 7 a.m.
9 a.m.
7.
You're such an asshole.
I love you, too.
Chapter 16. David and Goliath. As dear a friend as he was, and despite everything he had done for me, I couldn't repay Carlos with the one favor he requested.
Come on, Carlos whined. You owe me.
That is true, I nodded in agreement, but I can't do this. Carlos pushed the laptop across the table and positioned its keys under my fingers.
This should be the easiest thing ever. You're a writer. It's what you do. Now, write for me.
At the one-year mark of Carlos's diagnosis, his college had decided to honor him with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Carlos balked at the attention, believing his life was hardly remarkable.
They want me to give a speech, he said, laughing. They said I'm inspiring. Me. Ha!
He gestured at the computer again.
Go ahead, make something up. I have nothing interesting to say.
You're the most interesting person I know, I asserted, pushing the computer back to his side of the table.
I'm a shitty writer, Carlos moaned.
Just write something. Anything, I coaxed. Give me a draft, and I'll help you clean it up. Sound good? I didn't hear much from him for the next 2 weeks, aside from the occasional frustrated text message.
Writing is stupid. I sound like an idiot. I'll pay you to write this for me.
The day before the awards ceremony, Carlos requested an emergency coffee date.
It's as good as it's going to get, he sighed,
opening the computer. As I quietly read the speech, he winced in anticipation of my editorial critique. The screen began to blur as tears formed in my eyes.
It's perfect, I whispered.
And it was. I am not here for pleasant conversation. I am here to tell you about things that happen to people. Bad people and good people. Things that make some cry and question life's fairness and God's existence. But it's okay, because I know I am in good company. Many of you have likely gone through hell and back. I know, like you, how it feels being in pain, scared, hopeless, helpless, defeated, cheated, and alone. But I also know we are made of some tough stuff. Every one of us is equipped to climb over obstacles. We are all made to fight and never give up. A year ago, I was what people call super fit. My sport makes regular people cry in pain just watching it on TV. Ironman consists of swimming 2.4 miles, biking 112 miles, and then running 26.2 miles, a full marathon, in less than 16 hours. I have done this 13 times in races across the United States and Europe. I was in the midst of training for yet another Ironman last April when I suddenly got sick. It wasn't a gradual, progressive illness. One day I rode my bike for 6 hours, and the next I had emergency surgery. In an instant, everything changed. 1 year ago, I was told that I had stage 4 colon cancer, the most advanced stage of cancer. The tumors in my colon had metastasized to the lymph nodes and to the liver. With luck and chemotherapy, every oncologist said I could live another year, but the odds of survival beyond that were slim. Liver surgery is an option for some with my cancer, but I was not a candidate for it, as I had too many tumors. The doctors didn't say it outright, but I could tell what they were thinking. Start writing your will. I was in denial. I sought a second and a third and a fourth opinion. This type of thing shouldn't happen to me. This is a disease that affects old people, the overweight, the sedentary, the smokers. There is no cancer in my family history. I am 20 years younger than the average colon cancer patient. After being diagnosed with cancer, my main concern was how to break the news to my 10-year-old son. The prospect was daunting. How do I tell my son that his father is going to die soon? I took him for a walk, but it was difficult to even touch the subject. "Dad,"
Are you going to die? He asked. I tried to be philosophical. We are all going to die, son.
He replied, Yeah, but you know what I mean.
I couldn't lie anymore. I have a very, very serious, dangerous, mean disease that kills many people. Without flinching, he looked at me. Yeah, but you will fight it, right? You will beat it. I know you will. It broke my heart. I promise you I will fight this harder than anybody in the world has fought it. I will always fight. I will never give up, and I will never be afraid of it.
You promise?
I promise.
Dad, I think you are going to be the first person to beat cancer and finish an Ironman.
And that was it. If he could believe and hope for the best, so could I. I decided then that I was going to fight cancer with everything I had. I asked my oncologist for the most toxic chemotherapy poison he had and to double the dose. He smiled at me and said, Look, I'm an aggressive oncologist, but we want to kill the cancer, not you. We made an agreement. As a symbolic gesture to this fight I was going to start, he was going to change the goals of my chemotherapy in the medical record. My file originally said, Goal, palliative care, to extend life. He scratched that out and made a new entry. Goal, to cure. Chemotherapy was a bitch. Sorry, but that's the only one word I can use to describe it. During those 6 months, I didn't feel like I was getting better. I felt I was just dying faster. Fatigue, pain, nausea, insomnia, constipation, loss of motor function, permanent numbness of hands and feet, rashes. You name it, I had it. A blood test in month 4 of chemotherapy revealed the worst. Chemotherapy was not working. I was going to die. I drove to Mexico that night to say goodbye to my parents and my brothers and sisters. But halfway there, I turned around. I was ashamed of myself. This was not fighting. This was giving up. And I made a promise to my son that I wouldn't do that. That night at home, I wrote in my journal and to my friends on Facebook, The other day, I read an article picking apart the credibility of the David and Goliath biblical story. Could a teenage boy with a sling and stones really have killed a well-armored, trained-to-kill warrior? It was a funny question, I thought. Davids have been slaying Goliaths for centuries. Every day, all over the world, people like us, little Davids, get up in the morning and beat giants against all odds. Tonight I have decided that I am David. And cancer is my Goliath. It's a huge opponent, an experienced mutant killer. This fight is being held in a coliseum, and I don't want to be here. But Goliath is not well-liked, you know? He doesn't have a fan base. All the spectators in this coliseum have taken my side, and that makes a difference. They seem to think I am special, stronger, tougher than I actually am. It gives me pride. And for them, I can't quit. I am not fighting alone. In spite of the bad news that the chemotherapy wasn't working, I continued anyway, never missing a session, even when I felt like I couldn't take it anymore. 5 months into chemo, a new CT scan showed some tumors shrinking. By the end of my 6-month chemo treatments, I had learned many tumors had shrunk in size. And many more were dormant. Because I had fought, because I had stuck with it, the liver surgery that was impossible 6 months before was now possible. I had the first surgery on December 29th, the second on January 5th. Then, on February 7th, after a 7.5-hour surgery, I was cancer-free. It's not over completely. I still have 3 months of chemotherapy left, beginning Thursday. I have to tell you, I cannot wait to start. I am going to own these 4 rounds of chemo. I did over 6 months before, and 3 months pales in comparison. This is going to be cake. There is a chance that cancer will come back, a 60% chance that it will come back in 1 year, and a 75% chance that it will come back in 5 years. If it happens, I guarantee you I will fight it again. Cancer may destroy my body slowly, entirely, and definitely. But through it all, cancer will not touch who I am. Cancer can take away my ability to run really hard in the mornings, but it cannot take away my ability to enjoy the last few stars before sunrise while I slow jog and walk. It may one day take away my weekend bike rides with my friends up my favorite mountain and the breakfast after, but it cannot take away the camaraderie and love we feel for each other. Cancer has already taken away my ability to swim in the evenings, but the love of the sport doesn't go away. I still dream of swimming, and in my head I am Michael Phelps. Cancer has taken away, more than once, my enjoyment of a restaurant dinner with my family when I had to run to the bathroom to puke. But it cannot take away my love for them, or their love for me. Cancer can destroy my colon, take away my liver, clog my kidneys, and choke my lungs. But through it all, I refuse to let it grab hold of my heart or destroy my mind. Cancer won't make me a bitter person before it kills me. Cancer can destroy me, but it will not defeat me. I may not be strong enough to put my son on my shoulders anymore, but cancer won't ever take away the walks we already had together, when he held my hand, and in his mind there was no one stronger than I, when he thought I was untouchable, indestructible. Cancer cannot win. It will not win. Whatever your fight is, when you are thrown into the Colosseum to fight, you become a gladiator too. Half naked, with nothing but stones and a borrowed sword. If cancer comes back, it will be more aggressive, meaner, mutated. Honestly, I am not worried anymore. I am a little David, and cancer is my Goliath. And we all know how the story ends. Chapter 17. Life's too short to go so fucking slow. "You can drop me, you know," I let out a loud breath as I shifted gears on my bike. "Don't be ridiculous, Susan," Carlos replied with a smile. "I'm not dropping you. I'm serious. Go ahead. I'll meet you at the top of the mountain." But Carlos stayed by my side, relaxed and taking in the scenery around him. This was his new thing, he said, riding for fun, not for a personal record at Ironman, Arizona. Cancer, he said, had given him a new perspective on what was important in life. Part of me believed him, but another part of me knew, and was trying hard to ignore, the reality. Every week it was becoming easier to keep up with Carlos. Some days he'd even gesture for me to ride in front of him. "You're fit enough to take a pull now and then," he'd say gallantly. I was not fit enough. I was never fit enough. Still, I'd hop to the front and let him sit in my draft. 10 months before Ironman, Arizona, the scar tissue from 4 liver and lung surgeries made it too uncomfortable for him to ride his tri-bike, which demanded that he bend at the torso where his surgical incisions were still healing. This was upsetting for him. He adored that bike. But never one to accept defeat, he bought a road bike, which allowed him to ride in a more comfortable, upright position. I started to take more pulls, enough to warrant the purchase of a rearview mirror to keep an eye on him. With 8 months to go before our Ironman, the frequency of our rides together declined as his chemotherapy increased. When we did ride, he was tired, gaunt, and pale. I spent most of those rides checking on him in my rearview mirror and making sure I was giving him enough of a draft. This change in pecking order was difficult for both of us. Carlos had always been such a robust rider, yet now he struggled to maintain even the slowest pace. In our new style of riding, I never knew which was more important to protect, his body or his pride. But glimpses of strength would sometimes appear, usually in the form of his middle finger in my rearview mirror. I loved seeing that. That gesture of defiance made me feel like everything was still normal, that within that worn-down physical body was a brain that was still capable of telling me to stop being a dumbass. 7 months before Iron Man, the doctors pumped the brakes on treatment. The chemotherapy was incredibly effective at killing the cancer, but it was even more effective at killing the healthy cells in his body. The treatments had created a shell of a man. He wasn't eating, he could barely sleep through the pain, and his hands and feet had become numb with neuropathy. His white blood cell count was almost non-existent, and opportunistic infections kept landing him in the hospital.
"All this work trying to beat cancer," he'd joke under his breathing mask, "and I'm getting taken out by the common cold."
Then something amazing happened. With the cessation of the chemotherapy treatments, the old Carlos returned in full force. Food was appealing again, he clocked a solid 8 hours of sleep per night, and the color came back to his face.
"Riding tomorrow," Carlos texted me one Saturday night.
It had been almost a month since he had ridden. I felt joy swell up in my chest and went immediately to the garage to reinstall the mirror on my bike. He showed up in the parking lot between our houses the next morning, ready to ride. And boy, was he ready! I had barely rolled in on my bike when he gestured to South Mountain and led the way out at breakneck pace. Carlos was so happy, so fully alive, that he barely noticed or cared that I was struggling to keep up. For the first time in months, he was the one decelerating to keep the slower rider on his wheel. The order of things felt right again. Struggling to stay close, I wheezed, "Go ahead! Don't let me hold you back!"
"Nah, this is a nice, relaxing pace."
Did I detect a hint of smugness?
"I'm riding for fun anyway."
Pretty sure that was smugness. I put my head down and tried to stay on his wheel, refusing to sandbag his torrent of energy. Carlos started whistling a jaunty tune.
Definitely smugness.
As we climbed farther up the mountain, both my speed and his patience waned.
"Oh, for fuck's sake, Lakey,"
sighed Carlos as he stood up out of his saddle and pedaled away from me.
"Life's too short to go so fucking slow."
I rolled up to the top of the mountain 20 minutes later. Carlos was straddling his bike frame, leaning on the handlebars as he scrolled through the Facebook feed on his phone. He had been at the summit long enough to get bored. As soon as our eyes met, we exploded with hilarity. I don't think either of us had laughed that hard in a long time. Over post-ride coffees, Carlos talked animatedly about resuming his training for Ironman Arizona. If he could feel this good for the next 6 months, he'd have more than enough in the tank to complete the race. The old Carlos had bounced back. It was thrilling. Yet amid the laughter, the planning, and the big talk, we both suspected it might be fleeting. Eventually, even the highest bounces must return to Earth. And this one did. Although we didn't know it at the time, that morning was the last time we'd ever ride together. We had plotted a return to regular Sunday rides, but his body made other plans. In rapid succession, there were surgeries on his heart to remove blockages caused by the chemo port that had fed the medications into his bloodstream. Ablations followed to remove the tumors that returned to his body like invasive weeds during the absence of chemotherapy drugs. A tumor-filled wedge of his liver was removed. More than 20 rounds of chemotherapy followed. Our rides together were off, but Sunday mornings were still very much on as I continued my Ironman Arizona training alone. Each week I'd finish my ride and head to Starbucks, where Carlos would be waiting to swap battle stories. I'd tell him about bonking 60 miles into my ride, and he'd scold me for making stupid mistakes in my eating schedule. He'd tell me he walked around for 4 hours after invasive surgery, and I'd yell at him for being a show-off for the nurses when he should have been resting. He said he missed our Sunday morning rides. I missed them, too. In his absence, I tried riding with other friends, but it wasn't the same. Even in a Peloton, I felt alone. The plan was for Carlos and me to train for Ironman Arizona together.
and I felt sad and even guilty about riding without him. So instead, I'd ride my bike to the parking lot midway between our houses and wait for a minute before rolling out, just in case. 100 days before Ironman Arizona, I broke my bike. It was a stupid random occurrence, but a debilitating one. A crack in the frame rendered it unsafe to ride, and I scrambled to find an affordable replacement. That Sunday, over coffee, I was lamenting my lack of options to Carlos. A new bike was too expensive. A used bike was also too expensive. I wondered aloud if putting super glue on my fractured bike frame would really be all that dangerous.
"You fit on a 54-centimeter bike, right?"
Carlos interjected.
"Yes," I replied.
"Why?"
"Take my tri-bike."
The offer gave me pause. That tri-bike was his most prized possession. Carlos loved it so much that whenever anyone got near it, he'd wedge his body defensively in front of the frame. No one touched his bike. Ever.
"Take my tri-bike,"
he repeated.
"Swap out the pedals, get a fit at the shop, and make any adjustments you need to make."
I knew I had to ask the question we had avoided for so long. "But what about Iron Man?"
"The doctor wants me to do more chemo. I can't do the race."
We sat in silence, uncomfortable with the reality we had tried so hard to avoid.
"Take my bike. Do our Iron Man. You'd better go fast, though."
I smiled knowingly as I finished his sentence in my head. "Life's too short to go so fucking slow." That day, I finally accepted that I wouldn't be spending my training days chasing Carlos down on my bike. He had bigger mountains to climb. Nevertheless, each Sunday I rode to the parking lot between our houses and waited for a minute, just in case. But when I rode off on his bike, one thing was certain. I wasn't alone. Chapter 18. Prayers and Weed. Carlos did not want to be prayed for. A lifelong man of science, he did not believe in a deity. Fate was a load of bullshit. Divine intervention? Not a thing. So he couldn't understand why people kept saying it to him. "I'm praying for you," they'd intone, gently and reverently placing their hands on his shoulders. "If God brings you to it, he will bring you through it."
That phrase usually sent him flying. "Keep your God," he would snap. "I've got something better, an arrogant oncologist."
If they weren't offering up prayers, chances were good they wanted to share their weed. Suddenly everyone wanted to connect Carlos with a source for medical marijuana. Students, colleagues, neighbors, even fellow triathletes got in on the action, handing off a piece of paper at races with the name and phone number of their guy. Everyone, it seemed, had a guy, be it God or a guy with a dime bag.
"It's nice that people want to help," Carlos said one day, "but I don't need prayers and weed."
"I think people just want to feel like they're doing something," I surmised. I could certainly attest to the feeling. If I could have cured Carlos of cancer, I would have done it in a heartbeat. If I'd held the secret to taking away his pain, I would have done it. But unfortunately, I was neither a superhero nor an arrogant oncologist. I was just me, and when it came to cancer, I didn't have much to offer. It was a terrible, powerless feeling. I could understand how offering prayers or weed could at least make someone feel as if they were doing something to help.
"You want to know what would really help?" Carlos said.
I nodded.
"I could really use some hard candy."
His medication regimen had left him with a severely dry mouth. Drinking too much water nauseated him, but hard candy, specifically mints or lemon drops, brought temporary relief. After that day, I never left the house without a bag of candy in my purse. I was that guy for his certs fix. Supplication was difficult for Carlos, who was used to being self-reliant. He had no problem telling others to ask for help when they needed it, but he never considered taking that advice for himself. When those around asked with a pitying look how he was doing, when they made suggestions for treatment or offered prayers and weed, he eventually learned to state what he really needed, to shift the perspective from, "Look how sick you are," to, "Look how you're kicking cancer in the taint." If you had a lemon drop, he wouldn't turn that down, either. So, that was exactly what we did. As triathletes, we were proficient in the language of pep talks. If Carlos needed a cheering squad, that was what he would get. We took him out for coffee whenever he was feeling well. When he wasn't, we'd take pictures of our coffee and post them on his Facebook wall with random updates about our day, just as we would have talked about in person. The night before he was to undergo resection surgery to remove the diseased half of his liver, we flooded his phone with photos of his friends and family holding up signs of encouragement, just as we would in a race. When he was feeling particularly low, the Phoenix Triathlon community collaborated to create a special music video to Eye of the Tiger. Watching Speedo-clad triathletes dancing awkwardly made Carlos laugh so hard it caused a nosebleed. When he enrolled in an experimental treatment that required 2 weeks of total isolation in a hospital room, we set up shifts to keep him company through video chat. We ran in our tighty-whities in an Arizona knockoff of the Kona Underpants Run to raise money for a scholarship fund benefiting students at his college. There were times when Carlos would shake his head, blushing with embarrassment, and call us ridiculous. But he relished the ridiculousness, too. We could tell. We couldn't fix him. That was a job we had to leave up to the doctors. But the role we had was just as important. We could take his mind off things. We could bring him a sense of normalcy. We could buy him coffee and let him rifle through the pockets of our purses and backpacks, where he knew he could always find a peppermint. We danced in our Speedos. We made him laugh. On his 50th birthday, we packed into his house for the biggest surprise of his life. The doctors hadn't thought he'd make it to this milestone, so we would be damned if we didn't celebrate. "Modern medicine is amazing," Carlos said, as he looked around the house in awe. "But you guys, you're my secret weapon." Chapter 19. You Will Do This. For the 6 months leading up to the Ironman Arizona, Carlos was too sick to train, much less race, but he retained his role as my coach and number one fan. The day before the race, Carlos asked a mutual friend of ours to tape a letter on my bike frame when I wasn't looking. I discovered it as I was setting up my gear in the early morning hours before the race. "You will do this. Say it to yourself 1,000 times. Remember that during the race, just like during the several months of training you have endured, your body will question your sanity and give you hundreds of reasons to quit. Prepare your mind to have an answer for every question your body asks. Never forget why you are doing this. Eat often, pace yourself, and for fuck's sake, don't be a dumbass. Do those 3 things, and you will cross that finish line. But regardless of the outcome of this one race, you have made me so proud. In my mind, you have always been, and will always be, an Iron Man. Carlos." Little did I know just how much I would need those words of encouragement to carry me through that day. Chapter 20. Into the Light. In the month that passed between logging base miles to showing up at the start line on race day, endurance athletes endeavor to work out the kinks that may sabotage the race. We experiment with nutrition, shoes, clothes, and gear. We study elevation profiles and course maps with more focus than we ever studied anything in college. Because you reap what you sow when it comes to race day. But sometimes, despite your very best efforts and intentions, you get kicked in the gut. Ironman Arizona was my kick in the gut. Literally. In the 365 days that had passed since registering for Ironman Arizona with Carlos, I did everything I needed to ensure a perfect day. I trained well, ate right, and for the first time in my life experienced a complete absence of nerves about race day. I was confident. I was surrounded by friends. I had a purpose and a plan. I could feel it in my bones. This was going to be the race of my life.
As I jumped into the water and splashed my way to the start line with 3,000 of my new best friends, I smiled and cheered. The sun was shining, the lake was warm, and my fellow athletes were surprisingly courteous in the crowded swim. Everything was perfect. Until it wasn't. Halfway through the 2.4-mile swim, I caught up to the blood sport crowd. Punches were thrown, legs were grabbed, and I sustained a fierce kick to the ribs. Searing hot pain shot through me. Normally, I'd unleash the Kraken on anyone who dared to get physical with me, but I was too busy coughing up the gallons of bacteria-laden lake slime the kick had forced into my respiratory system. And, anyway, this was Iron Man, where the swim has often, and quite accurately, been compared to flailing around in a giant washing machine. Anything goes. So, instead of complaining, I struggled and spat, finished the swim, and hopped on my bike for a 112-mile ride, putting the swim behind me. Everything was perfect again. Until it wasn't. 10 miles into the ride, I began to experience sharp pains in my side. Thinking they were stitches, I tried breathing exercises to stretch out my diaphragm. That only made things worse. Still, I soldiered on, with no intention of being derailed by a silly cramp. This was going to be the race of my life, damn it. The next 102 miles can only be described as a shit show. I vomited, I bonked, I ached and struggled to breathe. My speed on the bike devolved as the miles passed, and I reached transition surprised that I was still upright. I was in more pain than I had ever experienced before. But I still had 26.2 miles of running to do. As I leaned over to lace up my shoes, the pain in my side was excruciating. But I stubbornly mustered up a smile. I was going to run. Period. Everything was going to be perfect again. Until it wasn't. It's been said that the Ironman Marathon is the place where you meet yourself. Inner voices that never existed before suddenly roar, weaknesses neglected in training become painfully clear, and new reserves of strength manifest themselves in awe-inspiring ways. I met myself at mile 10, and let me tell you, I'm a real asshole. Things I would never even think to say to another human being, much less one in pain, became perfectly acceptable to say to myself. Horrible, vile things blared between my ears with every step. How is this race honoring Carlos? You are an embarrassment. You write for a running magazine and you can't even hold a 13-minute mile? Pathetic! Neil finished this in 10 hours, and he's waiting for you. I bet he's mortified to even admit you're his partner. You don't deserve him. Your family flew all the way out here to cheer you on. You wasted their time. Everyone's making fun of you. Rightfully so. Just quit. You don't deserve to be called an Iron Man. As I ran along the crowd-lined sidewalk, I pulled my hat low over my eyebrows and tucked my chin, letting the darkness consume me. With every wretched thought, I felt my legs get heavier and heavier until I couldn't run anymore. In front of hundreds of people, I slowed to a walk, refusing to look up. You loser. Suddenly, I felt myself enveloped by one pair of arms, and then another. I looked up in shock and realized my walk had begun near a large group of my friends. Surrounded by their warmth and support, I felt myself begin to cry. Christine squeezed my shoulders, Ashley kissed me on the cheek and wiped away my tears, Dre put his arm around me and walked at my side. He passed me off to Jason, who held my hand as we broke into a jog. Heidi and Brian radiated quiet, calm strength. My family hugged me tight at mile 20. Neil told me he loved me, and that he was proud. I smiled at a row of touching, funny signs Carlos had asked friends to stake in the ground at mile 23. With every mile, I moved away from that inner darkness. 14 hours and 13 minutes after the start cannon fired, I entered the bright lights of the finish chute. I know I could get away with writing about the race of my life. I could easily churn out a contrived, inspirational paragraph or three about how I did an Ironman with a broken rib. I could write about mental fortitude or some such badassery. I could spew cliched generic wisdom, such as, pain is only in your head, or never, ever, ever give up. But all those things would be half-truths, and certainly would not tell the story of my Ironman Arizona. In fact, if I learned one thing during the race that day, it was that on my own, I am actually not that strong. Those voices in my head made damn sure I was aware of that fact. But the thing is, I wasn't on my own. Pain is temporary. Anger is temporary. Shit shows are temporary. Embarrassment, darkness, broken ribs. Temporary, temporary, temporary. And that day, I almost let myself believe they were a permanent part of my identity. Instead, I learned from my friends and family what is permanent. Love, support, joy. Few words were spoken, but their actions were sufficient to drown out the terrible voices in my head. Because of them, I can do anything. Even an Iron Man with a broken rib. "That was a very dumb thing you did," Carlos said as I showed him my x-ray after a visit to the doctor the next day. I shrugged. What was I supposed to do? A broken rib? Carlos scoffed. You quit the race and go to the hospital. That's what you're supposed to do.
Nah.
I draped the finisher's medal around Carlos's neck and grinned. I came here for a fucking challenge, and I got one. Chapter 21. Your mountain is waiting. Carlos could never resist a mountain. It wasn't its aesthetic appeal. Never once did I see him stop to take in the view from a lookout point. Nor was it for the physiological benefits of riding or hiking up one. A self-proclaimed desert rat, he didn't really care for the cooler temperatures of higher elevation, and the thin air of altitude sometimes gave him a headache. No, he said he liked the mountain because it was a challenge, something to conquer. It stood there, mocking him with its steadfastness and inciting fear with its sheer size. Mountains made him feel tiny, and he hated that. If a mound of earth rose somewhere on the horizon, no matter how large or small, Carlos would plot his way to the top of it, just to show that he could. Carlos was notorious for recruiting unwitting friends and training partners to tackle the mountain. "I'm doing a fun hike this weekend," he'd email. "You should come along." These fun hikes usually yielded seizing quads and sunburned shoulders for everyone but Carlos, who whistled his way through the switchbacks. At least someone was having fun. Every summer, he'd lure friends to long training weekends in high-altitude communities with promises of cooler weather and focused training, only to book the hotel rooms or campsites at the base of a mountain. To get to the top, and all its benefits, you had to ride your bike. One mountain in particular held his fascination, Pico de Orizaba, the highest mountain in his native Mexico and the third highest mountain in North America. He first saw it as a child on vacation and swore he'd climb it some day. There were other, more prestigious mountains, Everest or Kilimanjaro, but Pico de Orizaba, the first mountain he had ever seen, was seared into his brain. Every now and then, at the summit of a particularly precipitous hike or bike ride, he'd bring up Pico de Orizaba and dream up plans for a big group of us to train together, travel to Mexico, and finally conquer the mountain. It always came up in the context of someday, as in, someday when I retire from teaching, or someday when I'm done with triathlon. But when you're told you're going to die, someday no longer exists in your vocabulary. There's only today, and even that could be taken away from you at any time. When Carlos was first diagnosed with cancer, he rolled his eyes when people asked about his bucket list. "I'm going to be around for a long time," he would scoff, waving his hand in dismissal. He simply wasn't worried about what he thought of as a cliched, desperate grab for life experiences. But as the cancer progressed, it became clear that he had reason to worry. The scars from his surgeries hardened, limiting his range of motion. Chemotherapy treatments killed off nerve endings in his feet, creating a constant sensation of pins and needles when he walked. Lung tumors occupied the space where oxygen should go. A case of the sniffles became pneumonia, which became sepsis and kidney damage. His physicality suddenly had an expiration date.
"Fuck it," started the email he sent to his friends one day. "I'm going to do it."
Attached was an itinerary of his training and logistical plans for a Pico de Orizaba summit. He didn't have to trick anyone into training with him this time. We were all in. The hikes that had once made us whine and moan with disdain became a non-negotiable part of our weekends. Up the mountains in Flagstaff, over the peaks of Tucson, to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and back up again. We said it was an act of kinship, but in actuality, it was a measure of caution. The doctors had advised Carlos against strenuous exercise of any sort, but Carlos, who was used to self-inflicted suffering with triathlon training, didn't believe there was anything strenuous about going for a walk, which was what he called his excursions up the mountain. A walk. These were really hard walks. The air was thin at high altitude, and often cold. There were steep grades and unsteady terrain. For even the healthiest of us, going for a walk was an ass-kicker of a day. But for Carlos, whose lung capacity was shrinking by the day, it was a true test of body and mind. Training was a group effort, but when it came time to depart for Mexico, Carlos set out alone. Though he had always imagined making the sojourn with friends and family, something changed in him while he was training. Pico de Orizaba was his mountain, and he needed to conquer it alone. From his acclimatization hut at Piedra Grande, Carlos sent a brief update. Things were going as well as could reasonably be expected. A radiation treatment the week before had left him with a small nagging cough, but he was otherwise fine. Some people expressed concern that the small cough would eventually turn into a big problem. Was he sure this was a smart idea? Perhaps he should wait until his lungs healed from the radiation treatment. Even through email, we could hear Carlos scoff with incredulity. "The mountain is here today," he wrote, "and so am I." On the day of his planned summit, a group of us gathered to await an update. As we sat on couches, sipping coffee and waiting for word from Pico de Orizaba, the conversation turned to bucket lists. While training for his climb, Carlos had finally found a someday for a few other dreams, too. A hike up Yosemite's Half Dome, a tattoo on his upper arm, finding long-term security for a college scholarship fund he had established. After wrapping up a lecture one day, he overheard several of his students talking about wanting to go skydiving someday. Carlos had never really considered skydiving before, but hearing his students say someday struck a nerve.
"Let's do it," he interjected.
"Right now?" they replied nervously.
"Yeah, sure,"
he said, opening his laptop to search for nearby tandem jumps.
"Class trip, everyone."
Later that week, a dozen engineering students and their favorite professor jumped out of a plane. As we sat on the couch, awaiting word of Carlos's summit and laughing about our friend's fearlessness, I couldn't help but feel inadequate. That morning, I had spent 2 hours procrastinating on Facebook, hoping that cat memes and celebrity gossip would make my scheduled workout of hill repeats go away. Here I was, the possessor of a healthy body that still warranted the use of someday in my vocabulary, and I was bitching about hill repeats. What would I do if I knew I'd have no more somedays? More importantly, why wasn't I doing those things? Where was my mountain? I thought about my bucket list of wants. I wanted to travel the world. I wanted to write a book. I wanted to take Neil to a cheesy wedding chapel in Vegas and upgrade him from insanely hot boyfriend to insanely hot husband. I wanted to hike to the top of a volcano and see the lava bubble and churn. I wanted to finally finish an open-water swim without freaking about lake zombies. A laptop chimed, snapping me out of contemplation.
You guys, you guys, you guys! It's him!
Someone yelled excitedly. We gathered around the tiny screen of the computer as she clicked on the email, inciting loud applause and whoops. There stood Carlo.